On December 2nd, the state of North Carolina killed Kenneth Boyd by lethal injection. Kenneth Boyd is the 1,000th person to be executed in the United States since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Only days before Boyd's execution, another death row inmate narrowly escaped this dubious distinction. Robin Lovett's death sentence was commuted at the last minute by the governor of Virginia because evidence in his case had been unlawfully destroyed. Robin Lovett's case is not unique. Since 1976, over 100 death row inmates have been exonerated, some just days or hours before they were scheduled to die. For opponents of the death penalty, these last-minute reversals show that the system is filled with error and with race and class bias. Brian Stevenson is the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama, an organization that defends the rights of the poor and people of color. And he's joined us this morning by phone. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
People who support the death penalty often say that these last-minute reversals of death sentences, like the one in Robin Lovett's case, are examples of how the system really corrects itself and actually prevents errors from being made. What's your response to that argument?
I think it's deeply offensive. I've got a client who's been on death row for 20 years who is innocent. His name is Anthony Ray Hinton. If we succeed in getting him released, it's a great tragedy what has happened to him. There's nothing about exoneration for him that could be seen as success or the system working. And it's deeply disturbing to take someone and put them, lock them down 24 hours a day, try to kill them every day for years, and then realize that all of that's a mistake, and then release them, and then say anything about that is a success or a good system. It's pretty tragic what we've done to a lot of people by condemning them to death only to later discover they were innocent.
And in the case that you mentioned and in others where people are exonerated at the last minute, is that because the system provides for that, or is it really because of people like you and people in the media and the public putting pressure on the government?
Oh, absolutely. It's the latter. I mean, our system has actually made it harder and harder. It's far too easy for innocent people to be wrongly convicted and far too difficult to exonerate the innocent. Even now, Congress is considering a bill called the Streamline Procedure Act that would restrict the ability of innocent to death row prisoners and other people in prison to appeal their convictions and prove their innocence. And these restrictions on habeas corpus, along with the failure of many states to provide death row prisoners with legal representation. I mean, most people don't know that in the United States, you do not have a right to counsel. Even if you've been sentenced to death, after your case has been affirmed by the state's appellate court, and so we've got hundreds of people on death row in this country who are literally dying for legal representation. So these exonerations really reflect extraordinary activity by usually volunteers to keep the state from killing someone who is innocent.
And in your case, you're working in Alabama with death row inmates and providing some of that legal representation that they might not otherwise get. Are there other barriers in Alabama that make it hard for people to get legal representation?
Well, I think that we have a really underfunded system, like lots of states. About 70% of our death row population were actually represented by lawyers who, by statute, could only be paid $1,000 for their out of court time preparing the case for trial. And we don't provide lawyers to people after they've been sentenced to death for post conviction appeals. We have a very political system, so that in our state, elected judges. Can override a jury's verdict, so that even when the jury comes back with a sentence of life without parole, the judge can override that sentence and impose the death penalty. And nearly 24% of our death row received life verdicts from juries that were overridden by these elected trial judges. So there are just a kind of a range of obstacles that make this kind of work in Alabama very difficult, but it's reflective of what goes on all around the country. I don't think there's any state where the poor do not fare as well. I mean, that we've got a system in this country, that criminal justice system in this country, that just treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And all of that makes the death penalty especially problematic.
Your organization litigates on behalf of defendants whose convictions have been obtained on the basis of racial discrimination. Can you tell us a bit about some of those cases, and how is racism exhibited in the cases that you work on?
Well, I think it begins with the presumption of guilt that many people of color, particularly young men of color, have to overcome when they're charged with anything. We've tended to demonize and vilify young men of color, and so that presumption of guilt is very easy for people to imagine young African Americans and Latinos and other Native Americans as being guilty when they see them in the courtroom. And the state frequently doesn't have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That contributes to the race effects. Then we have other problems, racial bias in deciding who to seek the death penalty against. There's been a lot of research, and in most states, race of the victim is the greatest predictor of who's going to get the death penalty. The United States Supreme Court has been presented evidence about this, but they've never addressed it in a way that has created relief. We see it in racial bias in jury selection. Our office has handled 24 death penalty cases where prosecutors illegally excluded African Americans from the jury. In the case of Jesse Morrison, there were 21 African Americans qualified for jury service. The prosecutor excluded each and every one of them. All of that stuff contributes to how race and racial bias undermines the reliability of the death penalty.
How difficult has it been for your organization to prove racial discrimination in those cases? Have you had some success in getting sentences overturned?
We have had some success. As I've mentioned, we had those 24 cases where we were able to prove bias in jury selection. I represented a man named Walter McMillan who spent 6 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit, and we ultimately won his release. But it's very difficult. I mean, people don't like it when you start talking about race and you start talking about how the poor are not being treated fairly. There seems to be a mood in many parts of this country where people are just exhausted by the legacy of apartheid and slavery and Jim Crow and racial strife, and they're very reluctant to engage in honest conversation about these issues, even in death penalty cases. But we keep pushing it. In my state of Alabama, we have 19 appellate court judges, all of whom are white. There is only one black district attorney in the entire state. 66% of the people in prison are African American. And, all of those data, you would think, would require a conversation about is there a racial dynamic to some of these issues, and it's just very difficult to get people to engage with that. But in death penalty cases, we insist, and we have had some success in getting federal courts primarily to confront these issues.
In general, it looks like the number of death sentences in the U.S. is declining, but in Alabama, it seems, and in other parts of the South, that the population on death row is increasing. What does that geographic difference say to you?
Well, I mean, this is the region. We call these southern states the death belt. You mentioned the 1,000th execution. 80% of those executions have taken place in the Deep South. The handful of executions that have taken place outside the Deep South have been mostly volunteers. So it's the South and the use of, executions, lynching, frequently to kind of sustain racial subordination and other symbols of who has power and who doesn't, that has fought the hardest to kind of keep the death penalty as a part of its cultural life. And so I think that, you see some politicians, prosecutors, and others using the death penalty to express, their solidarity with people who are fearful and angry. And that's why I think you see these numbers where they are in the Deep South. In our state, it's also a function of politics. I mean, with judges having the authority to override a jury verdict, judges can do that and then run for re-election or run for a higher court and point to these death sentences as a way of proving how tough they are. And that kind of political use of the death penalty is very, very rampant.
You mentioned a kind of public exhaustion of talking about these issues and race and class issues. But do you think that public support for the death penalty in the United States in general and in Alabama in specific is declining?
Well, I do think that we've made some progress. I mean, I don't think anybody can dispute the fact that the death penalty has been defined by error. You mentioned the exonerations. For every 9 people who've been executed, we've proved that there's one innocent person on death row. It's a shocking rate of error. I just you know, if every for every 9 planes that took off, one would crash and folks would die, we would do something radical to keep those planes from doing that, and we would probably stop flying until we could figure out the problem. And so I do think that the evidence of error, the evidence of misconduct, has caused some folks to say we cannot do this and still be committed to fairness, committed to justice. Our integrity is on the line. Our commitment to equality is questioned and challenged by some of what we've been doing. And so I do think that has had some resonance. I'm afraid that there are voices in this country that are preaching fear and preaching anger and preaching retaliation, and it's those voices that have, in many places, kept the death penalty from being restricted even more. And that's what I see this struggle about. It's you know, confronting those who preach fear and anger and challenging that kind of voice with something that is more reasonable, something that's more thoughtful, something that's more committed to the fairness and equality we all claim to want to achieve.
And what's the status of the movements to abolish the death penalty, or at least push states to consider moratoriums on the death penalty?
Well, it's interesting. We've had a couple of states, you know, seriously take steps toward moratorium. In Illinois, the governor commuted all death sentences a couple of years ago, and there's a moratorium on executions still in effect in that state. Other states have talked about it. Maryland. There have been commissions in several states that have sought to restrict the death penalty. As you've mentioned, nationwide, the number of death sentences is down. But I think that there are still lots of folks who are going to use the death penalty to prove their kind of toughness, and they're going to push it as an issue. Interestingly, you know, internationally, we're quite isolated on this issue. We're one of the only Western democracies in the world that still executes people. And that oftentimes puts us in a very weak and compromised position when we talk about human rights in other countries. You know, going to some of these countries and preaching to them about human rights, like China or the Mideast, is difficult when we're doing things that they don't do in those countries. We only, just until this past March, we executed juveniles, and you couldn't do that in China. You couldn't do that in Libya. You couldn't do that in a lot of the countries we frequently condemn. So I think that we are making some progress, but there is obviously still a great deal of work that needs to be done.
And in addition to pushing for abolition, are you advocating any more immediate reforms to the system?
Well, I think that we have got to do something radical to improve the plight of poor people in the criminal justice system. We have to improve legal representation. We've gone from 200,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 to 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today. And we have increased our funding for police and prosecutorial services and victim services and a range of services, you know, exponentially. But we have done very little to upgrade indigent defense, and that's why so many innocent people end up wrongly convicted. We've got to improve how we treat the poor, how we address the needs of the poor in the criminal courts. We've got to be more honest about confronting the shameful legacy of racial bias and racial discrimination in the administration of criminal justice. And we've got to insist on sentencing and criminal justice administration that is less political, that is less compromised by getting votes, and more faithful to applying the law fairly and equally.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us this morning, Brian.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Brian Stevenson. He's an attorney and the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.